Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be checking in with Adam Boileau in just a moment to talk through the week's security news. And then, of course, it will be time for this week's sponsor interview. And this week's show is brought to you by Signal Sciences. But instead of having one of their staffers on the show, this week we're going to hear from one of their customers. Scott Behrens is a senior security engineer at Netflix, and he works on the Netflix product and application security team, and he'll be joining us to talk through the ins and outs of the AppSec program over there. That is a great chat, that one. I let it run long. But yeah, that is later. But right now, it is time for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, you remember last week when we were talking about how someone was interfering with the TrickBot botnet? And I said something along the lines of, this kind of has the feeling of something that came off a whiteboard at Cyber Command. about that.
About that, yes. Now, the news appears to be breaking that it was, in fact, Cyber Command all up in TrickBot. So, yeah, you totally called that one.
It was the vibe.
Yeah, like it did feel like a little coordinated. It felt a little different than usual. Didn't feel like the normal corporate takedowns, although we do know that there were some corporates involved as well, like Microsoft. I'm not sure if it's necessarily the same operation or whether it's a coincidence, but Microsoft was also taking down some of the C2 stuff in ways that we've kind of seen them do in the past. But yeah, this one did feel a little different, and yeah, turns out it was.
Yeah, so it turns out Cyber Command were interfering with the TrickBot botnet under the auspices of protecting the United States election, right? The integrity of the election and confidence in the election. Because I know, you know, US security officials have been quite concerned that an adversary could use the deployment of ransomware on or around the election as a bit of a spoiler, as a way to sort of erode confidence in the US election. I've seen some people pushing back on that on Twitter, some people in security saying, well, it's just a theoretical risk. But look, they have been thinking about this one and tabletopping this one for quite a long time. I can tell you that with certainty. They've been on this one for quite a long time. So I'm not surprised to see them move against TrickBot, much the same way that they moved against the IRA, the Russian IRA, that is, before the midterms or during the midterms a couple of years ago, back in 2018. So I'm not surprised to see them do this, especially when you consider that TrickBot has been linked to all sorts of shady state-sponsored stuff.
Yeah, but I think it does make sense. And when we talked last week, you know, we speculated a bit about the healthcare impact because the TrickBot had been involved in dropping the ransomware on the big hospital chain that we were talking about. But obviously focusing on the elections, you know, A, it's a thing that the Americans are particularly concerned about, you know, because it is a realistic thing that can happen. But B, also it's, you know, that they've got a little bit more mandate to, you know, go after and deal with things that are election related. And some of the tie-ups with TrickBot selling access to other actors, and North Korea is one example we've seen cited, you know, does kind of tend to nation-state territory. Both of those things are a little bit more in Cyber Command's wheelhouse than just like straight-up criminal stuff. And we've seen some people, you know, kind of suggesting that, you know, even if the technical risk to elections perhaps is, you know, part credible, who knows.
Well, hang on, TrickBot, there's a lot of TrickBot on state and county systems, right, that could be involved in the election process somehow. So, you know, it does actually connect up pretty well, I think. And I had a brief chat with Bobby Chesney about this. He wrote a piece on it for Lawfare, and he says, yeah, if this is squarely aimed at protecting the election, then this type of activity would fall squarely within, you know, the parameters of Cyber Command statutory authorities, right? So, which actually makes it less interesting, because if they had have done this because of the attacks against hospitals, that would be crossing a big line. But doing it because of the election, actually less interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny that, because, I mean, you know, it is a really interesting example of them, you know, acting against a network like this, where, you know, election interfering is probably only one thing that TrickBot could be used for, and we've seen it being used for a bunch of other stuff. But yeah, you're right. It would have been, and we don't.
They're taking action against the theoretical attack instead of the actual one, which is taking down hundreds of hospitals. You know, like, yes. It just seems a bit crazy.
I mean, it's a pleasant side effect, right, if they do disrupt TrickBot. And that's, you know, it's also not particularly clear to what extent this really has caused, you know, impairment to the operation of TrickBot in the short term. Perhaps some in the long term, you know, it doesn't really seem that way. You know, whether or not it's made a material difference, we don't really know. But, you know, anything that goes after those actors and makes their lives more difficult is a good side effect, even if it wasn't the primary reason. And we've also only seen, you know, one kind of part in public here, and there may well have been other actions going on. And, you know, we may see ongoing, you know, activity against TrickBot or, you know, some
Well, hang on. That's the part that comes next. But let's just stay with the Cyber Command bit for now. This could be signaling, right? They are talking about this. You know, the Washington Post comes out with four sources on this. They're clearly talking about it to certain media outlets. They're talking about it for a reason. So when people say this could be signaling, I tend to think the fact that Cyber Command is even discussing it supports that theory.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty straight line to draw. I mean, obviously Cyber Command's done a bunch of other things in the last kind of year or two, and we haven't necessarily seen them discussed in the same way as this. During the previous, you know, midterm elections, you know, we did see them saying, you know, we did do, you know, there was some signaling to Russian actors saying, hey, we are up in your stuff, we are watching you, just to try and, you know, kind of head things off. So the fact that we had some signaling then, I think, you know, this has signaling now totally makes sense.
It does. Now, where it gets interesting, though, right? So, as I said, this isn't about the hospitals. It's about a theoretical harm that could fall on election-related systems, right, in a few weeks from now. But this begs the question, couldn't you make the same argument for all botnets? Couldn't you make the same argument for Emotet in that case, in that it could be theoretically leveraged by a state to undermine the election, right? And if that's the case, why not attack them too?
I don't know that there's any good reason not to. I think it's very, yeah, absolutely, right? You know, we've seen plenty of evidence of other botnets being used, you know, to drop initial access as cover, you know, being used as, you know, unwittingly, you know, by other intelligence agencies to, you know, as vectors into places. Like, there's absolutely a line to be drawn from all of the other big operations because they're just such a natural good place to start. They're deniable. They provide the access that you need. They're less well protected than the networks you're trying to break into, you know, the malware operations themselves. So there's, you know, there's no reason not to go after the other ones under the same kind of logic to me.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? So doesn't even though we're saying it hasn't crossed a line, it kind of has, because what they're saying is that this botnet is a national security risk that justifies the involvement of a military organization.
I mean, it's almost like this is complicated.
But of course, you know, as you mentioned, there was another coordinated takedown, a whole bunch of companies involved, Microsoft, Symantec, Lumen, which used to be CenturyLink, all got involved and went after TrickBot C2. It's funny too, because while they were preparing their takedown, they were actually watching the Cyber Command thing going on and thinking, what the hell is happening here, you know? So everybody's having a crack at TrickBot. Microsoft used an interesting legal technique to get takedown notices from US courts, though.
Yeah, this one was funny in that Microsoft appeared to have used copyright law to justify their takedown of some of the infrastructure, their takeover of some of the infrastructure, on the basis that the attackers were using Microsoft's software development kits in ways that weren't permitted in terms of the license, which, I mean, sure, probably they weren't correctly, you know, abiding by the terms and conditions of use.
Hey, hey, it's one way to skin a cat, all right?
It gets the job done.
It gets, you know, the job done. This is the legal equivalent of, you know, it's not stupid if it works, right? But yeah, now they're saying exactly. This is a new precedent and they can use this against other botnets and whatnot. Now, we should point out Intel 471, that firm, they track TrickBot pretty closely. They say this hasn't actually had much of an impact. And of course, TrickBot does have fallback C2 methods, among them a Tor C2 and Emma DNS, which is like a blockchain-based DNS that I'd never heard of until you know, a few days ago, and I've been reading up on Emma DNS. But yeah, I mean, it's all happening, man. But it doesn't look like it's been a terminal blow to TrickBot just yet.
No, and some of the commentators have been suggesting that, you know, whilst this isn't going to be effective, you know, in the immediate term against, you know, sort of such a complicated operation, multi-headed operation like TrickBot, that anything that increases the overhead of operating an environment like that is still useful. And if we do see, you know, kind of continued friction,
friction's the word they were using a lot, yeah.
Yeah, to try and just, you know, make the cost of running it and make it fiddly and annoying and a pain in everybody's ass. And if they keep doing that, then, yeah, maybe it does provide something, even if it isn't a long-term, you know, completely kill the whole thing dead in the water.
Well, we've seen a few people say that this falls under Cyber Command's whole persistent engagement model, and that's going to be a big pain in the ass for the TrickBot operators if they're just going to have a few operators dedicated towards, like, hassling them, right, and making their life hard. And I really do wonder if this was a shot across the bow, you know, a bit of signaling, or whether or not it's the beginning of just a campaign of harassment against the TrickBot operators. Because I would not want Cyber Command harassing me, you know, and just trying to make my life hard, because that's an asymmetric thing, you know, you're going to lose.
Exactly right. And even just knowing that they're there, that you're on their targeting list, that there's people tasked to mess with you, and you don't, you know, right now it's, you know, cyber, it's low level, but who knows what other stuff might be happening, what else is going on, and that's got a weigh on you, right? I mean, anytime you're involved with a criminal syndicate, you've got that kind of, you know, the fear of what might happen to you hanging over you, and now you've got a little more focus, then, yeah, I mean, that's going to affect people psychologically as well as, you know, the kind of technical and operational aspects.
Well, I am kind of surprised. I got to say, I am kind of surprised that if Cyber Command were going to do something here, they didn't just own the C2s and actually have the malware uninstall itself. I am surprised. There's got to be a reason why they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, there may well be. And, you know, there's a bunch of kind of technical lines that maybe they're trying to cross. And we've seen, you know, some of those arguments made in the past about, you know, making anti-worm worms and stuff that maybe were just not worth the hassle of trying to argue now. And also, you know, a campaign like this is pretty new. Maybe they're just going to try the, you know, the gentle option, don't go too hard, see what happens, get a feel for it. And then maybe the next one we see is a bit more, you know, take no prisoners.
Well, I saw in some reporting, Krebs has been doing a good job on this one as well, but in some of the reporting there was, you know, apparently they're all pissed off, the TrickBot operators, and they're going to boost their ransoms to try to recoup their losses. And I'm just thinking, guys, when you've just been rumbled by Cyber Command, you know, sticking your head further out, probably not the way to go.
Yeah, not so much.
Yeah.
But
you know, that's the sort of hubris that happens when you're a, you know, 20-something-year-old cyber crook with millions of dollars, right, in Bitcoin. You're going to think you're invincible.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, they certainly have been pretty untouchable. You know, if you operate in Russia within the kind of constraints imposed upon you by being in Russia, then, you know, don't go on holiday in Thailand or whatever, then yeah, they have been. And maybe, you know, this is a sign that those times are changing a bit.
All right, let's move on. Wired has actually, Garrett Graff actually published a big profile on the Cyber Command director, Paul Nakasone. So that's just a reading list item. Did you get through it?
Yeah, and it's really interesting, you know, bit of background of a guy that's, you know, pretty influential in, you know, NSA and Cyber Command, and, you know, is probably responsible for a bunch of the things that are going on now. So yeah, good contextual reading for what's going on there. He doesn't sound like a super exciting guy, but that's perhaps what you want at the helm of something like Cyber Command.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, he's, you know, he likes pencils. That's something that they, Dustin Volz from the Wall Street Journal was kind of saying that this piece, well, let me read the tweet. The director of the NSA is so boring, the most interesting thing about him is that he really likes number two pencils and has an oversized pencil gift sitting in his otherwise spartan office. Which I think is a little bit cruel, right? I mean, you probably don't want the director of Cyber Command and NSA being, you know, life of the party guy, like
yeah, exactly,
skateboarding around the office. Like, I don't know, let the man like his pencils. I think it's fine.
Yeah, fair enough. Number two is a perfectly fine number of pencils. So yes, you have our approval, General Nakasone.
Indeed. Now look, staying with US government agencies, the FBI and DHS have said that APT crews are now using that domain controller bug that popped up a few weeks ago, that real serious one where you could just get insta domain admin. No surprise there that people are using bugs, I guess.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the guts of the story. Bug came out. Hackers now will use the bug to get shells, perhaps patch your stuff, or look for the bug, or maybe both. You know, it makes sense that a bug like this is going to be picked up by a bunch of different operators, and, you know, APT crews using this, you know, inside all sorts of interesting places, you know, unfortunately, it makes a lot of sense. So, you know, reminded everybody to patch your stuff. You know, when DHS is telling you to patch your domain controllers, probably you should patch your domain controllers.
Yeah, that sounds like reasonable advice. Norway has said that a recent intrusion into its parliamentary systems was conducted by Russia. Colour me surprised. No way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, Russia's very, you know, interested in what goes on in that region of the world, and being up in the Norwegian parliament makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, no surprises at all.
But Russian organizations are having their own troubles at the moment, Adam. There's a group out there of Russian speakers pretending to be Chinese, hacking Russia-based organizations. Is that right?
That seems to be the story, yes. So whether it's Russians pretending to be Chinese or whether it's somebody else who speaks Russian, Ukrainians, pretending to be Russians, pretending to speak Chinese, maybe it's the Chinese speaking Russian. Who even knows anymore? But the point
you
is
you think the
that
Chinese learn to speak Russian and then are pretending to be themselves?
I mean, you know, it's wheels within wheels, man. I'm not sure anymore. But point is, Russian organizations are being targeted by other Russian speakers, according to reporting. And, you know, that doesn't sound, you know, that incredible given, you know, the things that are going on in that part of the world lately. But yeah, I mean, it's just so hard to tell what's going on anymore. The news is also confusing.
We got another Cyber Command story here, and I think they buried the lead, because I think the lead here really is that Cyber Command actually does pretty good Photoshop.
Yeah, this is a release from Cyber Command where they dropped some, you know, malware and virus total that they attributed to you know, Chinese APT group. But yes, they dropped it with this like sweet photoshopped meme, I guess, for the group, which is called Slothful Media. They photoshopped a pair of headphones on a sloth and they put a moon, and they released it on the day of the Chinese Moon Festival. I wonder if that could be related.
But yeah, according to this story in CyberScoop, this one's by Shannon Vavra and Sean Lingas. This is, Chinese operators targeting Russia and India.
Yeah, and a bunch of other places. I think we've seen, Malaysia, Kazakhstan as well. Some criticism, I think, in terms of the quality of the work. The slothful in the name apparently refers to the relatively lazy approach to coding their tools. So, yeah, a bit of shade being thrown thrown there against
that's
the Chinese operators.
21st century cyber weapon is shade via Photoshop. Hell of a way to win a war, but why not?
Yeah. Hearts and minds in the dank meme department at Cyber Command.
Continuing our theme of everybody hacking everybody else, we got one here from Raphael Satter and Christopher Bing at Reuters.
Yeah, so this is a write-up of a group that's been, you know, seen operating in a bunch of environments, but the diversity of environments being targeted is kind of interesting. We've seen, you know, kind of Sikh separatists and Pakistani military and, you know, commercial organizations and all sorts. And the conclusions being suggested here is this is another one of these kind of commercial, you know, kind of mercenary hacker outfits being tracked down here from reporting from BlackBerry Silence, you know, looking into the set of campaigns. And yeah, the idea that there are commercial operations out there, you know, isn't surprising. We talked about, what was it, the Bellatrox actor coming out of India a little earlier on in the year. But yeah, interesting when, you know, trying to figure out who's behind something and it just doesn't make any sense. Maybe it's just money behind it.
Yeah. Meanwhile, a public broadcaster in Germany has done a really detailed report into Ocean Lotus. This is, of course, the Vietnamese APT crew. And it looks, you know, from the looks of this story, it looks like they are really an all-purpose APT crew. You know, it's not like other countries with more developed capabilities where they tend to split off into different units for different purposes. Like, these guys seem to do the lot.
Yeah, the report talks about some kind of, you know, Vietnamese people who fled persecution or fled, you know, political situations inside Vietnam. In this case, you know, a guy that's residing in Germany. That's, you know, kind of under constant attack by the Vietnamese APT crew, and, you know, for political reasons. But we're, you know, the same crew has obviously been doing a whole bunch of other stuff, as you suggest. Like, they're the general purpose crew for anything that needs to get cybered out of Vietnam. But yeah, it's just a really interesting write up when it's been done by, you know, a media organization, you know, that's outside of the normal cybers, and seeing their, you know, the way that they're trying to explain this to the more general audience. It's actually really interesting. I quite liked the way that they, you know, wrote it up and tried to explain it without losing a whole bunch of the technical detail, but also explaining it relatively clearly. So it's, yeah, I thought it was a good piece.
Yeah, they got sort of like pseudo animations and stuff in it. It's a good one to show normies, I reckon, that piece.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
The Five Eyes is now Seven Eyes.
so, five, you know, and change eyes.
So you know how like every single year at about this time, the Five Eyes governments come out with a joint communique saying that E2EE is of great concern and technology companies need to do more. They've basically dusted off last year's communique and put it out again. But this time India and Japan have signed up as well. But I mean, it's the same old stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much exactly what we saw in the last year's one, you know, some acknowledgement that end-to-end crypto is important and useful in a commercial context, and that people do have some rights to privacy, and that governments in general in the West are willing to give up on, you know, mass surveillance in the kind of way that the golden age of SIGINT, you know, would have liked. Willing to give that up a little bit, but, you know, they do expect Facebook and social media companies and tech companies to come up with something so that lawful intercept is still an option, so that, you know, law enforcement can do stuff. But yeah, basically the same kind of statement that we saw last year. You know, and for governments like ours here in New Zealand, they haven't really started the process of trying to turn that into some actual legislation, you know, watching what other countries like Australia's, you know, assistance and access bill, which is a little closer to what this Five Eyes statement is kind of asking for. Seeing how that turns out is the smart move for people like us, but who knows what's going to happen after the election in the US and Lindsey Graham and, you know, their movements against big tech over there. So, you know, maybe more things will happen.
You know, where we landed on that yesterday, because I did work with Brett on this section of the newsletter, do subscribe, everyone. I'm just going to say it again. but yeah, I think we covered it off. Here's our last paragraph on it. At the risk of repeating ourselves, the use of E2EE in and of itself doesn't prevent a service provider from responding to a lawful access request. Service providers could choose to build mechanisms into their platforms that allow for access to user content when served with a warrant, but here be dragons. Any such proposals will be pretty fraught in the details, so the can gets kicked down the road once again. We can hardly wait for the 2021 statement. So that's where we're
pretty much,
you know, it's still a hard problem with no easy solution. Ping of Death, the Ping of Death is back. And, you know, Sophos actually did a great write-up on this. Microsoft has said there's a CVSS, like, I think it's a CVSS 9.8 in
it's a good one.
On like the ICMP handler under their, in their IPv6 component. So it's like a straight up IP stack security bug, which Sophos says they've got a POC working for like Ping of Death for like DOS Win 10 with it. But we were chatting before we got recording, and you reckon, you know, someone might eventually figure out how to exploit this.
I mean, it's a pretty interesting bug, you know, and if this bug had landed in Windows XP, you know, or something that didn't have modern exploit mitigation tech, then this would have been a planet melting bug. Like an IP stack, you know, remote code exec, single packet, off you go. Like that is...
Well, in
like
V6 as well, so a whole bunch of firewalls are going to miss it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like it is, it's, you know, it's the bug that 10, 15 years ago would have been amazing. And now it's just kind of, you know, we're crashing boxes, a bit meh, which is sad in a way. Exploit mitigation works too well, ruins everything. But it's, as I gather, a pretty much straight up, you know, kernel space, Stack Overflow, parsing like the list of name servers in an IPv6 router advertisement message. And unfortunately, the relevant components are compiled with, you know, stack cookies and address route randomization and where. And yeah, Sophos' assessment is that this is going to be difficult to shell remotely. There's no word on whether or not a local attacker might have more options, which is, you know, for local privesque would, you know, be worth considering perhaps. But yeah, this is going to get, you know, there's going to be a lot of people looking at this bug, because if you can make it work, you know, you're going to be happy.
That's really like, you know, Scorpio from the Simpsons. I mean, gentlemen, I have the doomsday device, you know, like at that point, you know, that's a god mode bug, right? If you can
it
make
is,
it work.
Right? IP stack remote. I mean, we haven't seen one of those for a very long time, you know, like modulo FreeBSD's one last year or whatever, but it doesn't really count. But yeah, it's you know, that's a hell of a bug. And I, you know, part of me wishes it was genuinely like straight up code executable, because, you know, we'd love to see things burn a little bit sometimes, but yeah, I mean, exploit mitigation tech, this is why we have it. And this is, you know, justification for all the work that's gone into exploit mitigation stuff over the years, because it just saved your ass a whole bunch of trouble, Microsoft. So I guess good job there. There's a bunch of other juicy bugs in Microsoft's patches this month too, right? There's a SharePoint, a bit of a doozy of a SharePoint bug. There's some Hyper-V bugs. Yeah, I mean, it's good collection. So as usual.
And there's a GDI Plus RCE. Is that going to be like a nightmare to patch as well, because it's been statically included in all sorts of applications? Are you going to get owned from your, like, you know, third-party BMP editor?
I mean, that's a good question. That's why, you know, it's a you know, that kind of system, it can be really hard to tell, you know, whether it has been embedded, compiled and stuff.
Do you remember when there was that really bad GDI bug years ago, and Microsoft actually had to ship a tool that would scan your system to see if it was on your box?
I mean, yeah, it may well end up like that. And we, you know, we've seen that kind of thing with, you know, compression bugs, Edlib and you know, libpng, yeah, and things like that, yeah, that get compiled into stuff. So yeah, like those sorts of bugs deep in the graphics system in Windows are you know, have in the past really delivered the goods.
But it doesn't matter because I'm sure all of your application providers are using technology like SNCC to fully understand their code supply chain, right? So no problem at all.
None whatsoever.
Software AG, having a bit of a hard time over there in Germany.
Yeah, it's a big software vendor. They've been hit by the Klopp ransomware gang, who have encrypted a bunch of their stuff, stolen a bunch of their files, are demanding apparently more than $20 million worth of ransom. Software AG is it's a pretty big company, but $20 million is a lot of bucks for anyone.
Yeah, it is. Funnily enough, I had an interesting chat this week with Michael Montoya, who's the CISO at Equinix, about their ransomware event. We're going to try to get him on the show at some point to talk about it. But that was a fun chat. Like, it was just a case where, you remember, we were like, how the hell did these attackers not get into the customer, you know, environment?
Yeah, exactly.
And Michael said, you know, they had some segmentation and stuff, and it was like, it wasn't perfect, but it was just good enough to, like, their blue team and their defenses were just good enough to stop this particular crew. And it was a bit of a knife fight, but they came out basically on top by the end of it. So there's more to it than that, but I'm hoping we can do that as a case study at some point when we've got time. But it was a really interesting chat with Michael. So thanks, guys. If you're listening, that was cool. And now we've got a bit of a feature here from Brian Krebs at Krebs on Security, just really looking more at the business environment for people involved in ransomware.
And in fact, you know, it's a really good kind of dovetail to that anecdote about Equinix, because the thing that Brian's talking about is crews that advertise on Russian forums for operators to take things where the initial compromise has already happened and then go and do all of the hard work to turn that into, we understand the business, we've stolen all the data, we've compromised everything we need to, you know, do all the lateral movement, privilege escalation, get into the point where you can actually deploy the ransomware to make the money. And that's actual proper work. And they're, you know, he's talking about a guy called Dr. Samil, who's been advertising for people to do exactly that, you know, as a commercial service for other Russian or other criminal operators. So, yeah, it kind of makes sense. Like, the economics is exactly why you would want to go and, you know, outsource this through a specialist rather than, you know, making a mess of it and not getting, you know, extracting the full value.
I actually think, you know, regular businesses could learn a little bit from the way cybercrime operates, because, you know, talk about your fully distributed engineering models, like, and just, yeah, I just think they do it pretty well.
They do outsource to a center of excellence of privilege escalation and lateral movement. That's the smart thing to do. Of course, Krebs writes that up, and then just at the end, because he has to, because it's Krebs, he goes ahead and just doxes the guy that he's talking about. You know, drops his name and where he lives and stuff. And just a little couple of sentences at the end. Oh, by the way, his name's Sergey, and he lives in wherever it was.
He's probably using a hot wallet BYO lead pipe.
Yes.
Basically, yeah. Nice one, Brian. Okay, so we're finally going to have to actually have a conversation about this topic. A little one. Unfortunately, we're going to finally have to wade into this conversation, which is about offensive security tooling. There's a subset of people in InfoSec who feel like, you know, releasing tools like Mimikatz is really irresponsible because bad guys use them. And we actually touched on this in a recent episode where, you were saying, like, a lot of these offensive security tools were actually created to mimic the bad guys' tools, but now the bad guys just use the ones that were designed to mimic them. So it's like life is imitating art a little bit. But yeah, this guy, Paul Litvak, he's a security researcher from Intersa Labs, has put together a presentation looking at the issue of offensive security tools being used by malicious attackers. It's interesting, right? I'm glad someone's finally done some real work on this instead of just feel opinions being thrown around on Twitter, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say as well, like actually having some data to contribute to this debate, because written right now, it's just been a lot of Twitter kind of backward and forward from the different camps that really don't have a lot of middle ground to agree on. And having some actual data, like understanding which tools are being used in which kind of role in actual intrusions and actual sets of, you know, kind of tool chains that real attackers are using, that's useful data. And it's an interesting kind of map that the guy has put together of, you know, where, you know, Mimikatz, for example, is, you know, widely used for lateral movement, but in some some of the other areas where it's, you know, there's a less dominant offensive security tool, then it's kind of interesting to see which are being used and try and draw some conclusions. You know, one of the things he suggests is that the more simple tools, the ones that do one thing well, are the ones that tend to get picked up and used, whereas the more kind of, you know, fiddly or clunky or, you know, require more human input omnibus tools are less well adopted, which I guess is an interesting insight. But, I mean, the overall kind of discussion is, you know, there's good points on both sides, and that makes what makes it kind of difficult.
Well, I mean, sort of. The thing where it falls down for me as a debate is what do you expect to do about it, right? Like, say you lock up a lot of these offensive security tools, say they're not open source anymore and there's some vetting. I mean, it's not terribly hard to get yourself a pirated copy of IDA, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, Cobalt Strike is licensed and yet it's widely used by attackers. I mean, if that model was going to work, it would work for Cobalt Strike.
And well, and you know, you just saw the Brian Krebs story about the guy with a specialty. I mean, you know, next time Sergey will be offering tools, right? Like, that's going to be the thing. It might cost him a little bit of money, but I don't think it's going to make a meaningful impact.
In fact, I think the Sergey in the previous story was actually providing the people with, you know, Cobalt Strike specifically to go and use in the environments, right? It's part of the package deal. You get the access, the tooling, the entry point. Now off you go. So, yeah, I mean, like that angle I don't think is working already.
Yeah, so I just don't. I mean, this is where I haven't really discussed this, and I'll get hate mail on this, and people will be like, no, offensive security tools are bad, okay? But it's like, okay, sure, but what do you expect to do about it? Like, I just don't think there's really a solution here, which kind of, to me, makes the debate feel a little bit moot.
Yeah, and I think if you look back in the history, in the 90s, a lot of the hacker tools were underground, right? You did have to know people to get them. They weren't freely available. The rise of open source security tools was a bit later on, you know, and it didn't make things better back when you had to go trade on IRC channels to get, you know, packet sniffers or, you know, port scanners or whatever, or, you know, password crackers, you know, it didn't make it better back then. So yeah, I think, you know, some look at the history suggests that, you know, you're not really going to fix this.
Ah, some young people are a whole bunch richer at the moment, Adam, for doing cool stuff.
Yeah, there's a really great write-up from a crew of bug bounty kids who sat down and spent, you know, 2-3 months working on Apple's infrastructure. And they ended up reporting something like, 55 bugs to Apple's bug bounty program, which Apple has now been kind of working through and addressing. And some of these bugs are pretty significant. Like, they managed to bug chain up through, I think, a Jive, like, portal instance into, you know, CodeExec inside Apple's network, and a bunch of other, you know, really interesting bug chains that have netted them at the moment, I think, $288,000 worth of bounties. I'm not sure if that's even the final number. Obviously, Apple has to triage all of the things that they've reported. But they did a really great blog post writing up a bunch of their bugs and the methodology and the processes and things. And it's just, yeah, it was really, really solid work. And if you kind of work the numbers about how much time they spent and what they made out of it, it's pretty good money. So good job.
Yeah, I mean, this story here on Wired, Sam Curry, who was one of the researchers, who's apparently 20 years old, way to go, Sam, he spoke to Wired about this, and apparently they could be looking at about $500,000 by the time all is said and done. So well done to Sam and his fellow travellers, Brett Burhaus, Ben Sadikipur, Samuel Erb, and Tanner Barnes. Well done to you. And our final story this week, Adam, Swiss Post has gone from zero to hero when it comes to running a bug bounty program.
Yeah, this is interesting because it's a follow-up to a story we covered a while ago now, where they had a bug bounty program for election software in Switzerland, and then a bunch of researchers decided to drop stuff without going through the bug bounty program because they disagreed with the terms of it. There was some kind of non-disclosure stuff that they felt was unreasonable. There was a bit of back and forth and disclosure drama, and now the Swiss Post has kind of worked over its language for running a bug bounty program, and the way that it interacts with Swiss law is kind of interesting. But yeah, the net result is they've released it under Creative Commons license so that other Swiss organizations can use that as a starting point for their own bug bounty programs. And I think this is a really good idea. You'd like to see this, you know, happening in other jurisdictions. And it's the sort of thing where you could imagine, you know, the local certs in individual countries building some boilerplate wording that other, you know, organizations can use inside that jurisdiction. So yeah, I think this is a good story.
Well, mate, that's actually it for this week's news. Big thanks for joining us, and we'll do it all again next week. Cheers, Adam.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Signal Sciences, which has apparently been acquired by Fastly, right? So might have to update that at some point, maybe next time they come on. But yeah, instead of having one of their staff on the show, Signal Sciences asked one of its customers to join us instead. Scott Behrens is a senior security engineer at Netflix, and he joined me to talk through their approach to application security. As it turns out, their challenge isn't really on the streaming platform side. That's actually pretty simple. But it's more to do with all of the other applications that they host. And there's a lot of them. Scott Behrens explains.
Let's actually talk through it. Like, if we think through like the threat model of the streaming product, or even just the architectural complexity, it's not like a super complex authorization model. You're a member or you're not, you know?
Yeah.
So if we think through like a lot of the typical attacks, we'd think, like there's just not a whole lot there in the streaming product. Now, streaming product has all sorts of other security concerns though that we have to take into consideration: fraud, customer trust, abuse, all sorts of spaces. And that's actually where the majority of the focus on a streaming product is really around maintaining and establishing that customer trust. Now, where the complexity on the security side in the app space comes in is actually really around that studio use cases, the supporting use cases, all the stuff that makes that streaming product great. And actually, that's thousands of different applications that are sort of rolled in there with way more complex operating models. You know, you might be a production manager shooting content over here, whole set of access control related to that. Or you might be an administrative assistant over here. We have to do on behalf of permission modeling over here. So there becomes this really complex sort of supporting story to Netflix. And that has been really cool for me. I started when mostly on the streaming side and working to build security there. And as we started to expand and do the studio stuff, just a lot different. There's a whole different threat actors.
So are you building like administrative support systems for some of these productions, right? So like you're spinning up the next season of Narcos or whatever, and they need a HR system. So boom, that's a web app, go.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff you can imagine, you know, in the studio. We just have a lot of velocity, a lot of really cool technology there. And so, you know, what we want to do is we need to, as security practitioners, we need to figure out like, how do we sort of like increase or like let teams stay with that velocity without like getting in their way, right? Like to put another way, like we don't want to be blockers because I've worked at companies where like security is kind of the blocker. And then what people end up doing is they either don't talk security or they find every way possible to like go around security. And so, you know, we have to find that balance. Like, how do we keep them fast, but also keep them safe? And that's one of the interesting things. That's why I've been at Netflix for so long is like, I find that's a tough area to straddle. Really. Mm. Yeah.
So what are the typical things look like that worry you most in this scenario? Because I imagine there's a lot of IP protection concerns on that, right? Like you don't want leaked scripts and videos and whatnot. I mean, I guess that's less on the application security side, but that would be top of mind, right? Generally speaking.
Yeah. You know, we focus on all sorts of different threats. And if, you know, if we were to sit down and think about like, you know, an application that manages content, a lot of different sort of things come to mind. You know, how would we steal that, you know, for an attacker, how would we steal that content? How do we, you know, corrupt that content? How do we get access to that type of information? So, you know, a lot of the threats that I'm thinking about, a lot of it relates to data exposure, frankly. And I think that's common in a lot of organizations. You know, it's like, how do we keep our data safe? And I think unique to Netflix is, you know, Netflix has a lot of data, just like a lot of companies do. And so we have to be real sort of judicious on how we manage that data and do it safely. And a lot of my efforts in the last 2 years have actually been on the data side, figuring out like, what is our data strategy in support of these big areas of Netflix? And it's such an interesting place because, you know, data is, there's so much of it. Well, the best way to put it, like, you know, I don't know exactly how much we're logging, but I know that it's a lot. Like there's just a wild amount of data that's like sort of flowing through our ecosystem. And how do we safeguard it? How do we make sure that developers and business analysts are using it responsibly? It's tricky.
So again, this is more talking about the applications that you're using internally to look at things like user analytics, things like that. What people are watching, how long they watch it for before they turn it off, how many episodes before they lose interest, all of that stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, that's one part of it. And then, you know, how do we spend our dollars better? How do we secure things better? Like, where's our risk? There's a lot of sort of motivating factors for sort of keeping that data. And I think that, again, one of the things that makes Netflix interesting is, like, you know, my main focus is, like, keeping Netflix secure. It's also staying within our culture and making sure that I'm not introducing unnecessary friction. Like, I guess to put a different way, I want to be very cautious of doing any security work that I really can't make a good justification for, because people at Netflix, you know, rightfully so, like, they kind of want to know the context. Like, why do I want to change my process? Why do I want to add this new security widget to my thing? And so, you know, we try to work a lot on our messaging and just being very clear with how we communicate with partners. And I think that's worked well. I would almost say that we're partnership focused to a certain degree. Like, I used to work as a consultant, and I would just pen test apps all the time when I first started on Netflix, and I just kick reports over the fence, right? So I'd beat up an app, find every possible vulnerability you could in it, and I'd just, like, kick a report over. And I was like, I'm successful at my job. I'm like, I find bugs and kick reports over. And then, like, you know, 6 months into my job, I realized, like, the findings weren't getting fixed. Like, people weren't talking to me. And kind of realized, like, oh, actually, I just was sort of kicking stuff over the fence.
Well, it's that old saying, isn't it? You know, if you walk into a room and everyone in the room is an asshole except you, maybe there's only one asshole in the room.
Yes, exactly. And I feel like that is, like, exactly what happened with me. And that's kind of when we kind of realized our approach really wasn't working. Like, we needed to be a little bit more partner focused and find out, like, how do we straddle, like, actual security work versus, like, other opportunities and all that.
So how do you begin to tackle that, right? Because that's you know, that's an issue that I'm sure many of the listeners are grappling with. You know, I'd imagine for a lot of people I know who've found themselves in similar situations, a lot of it is about coming up with almost like a bit of a template or a guide for the people that they're tasked with sort of, you know, helping, you know, producing a bit of a guide or some guide rails, like, do it this way, you know, like, and then corralling everyone into sort of uniform approaches. Is that the approach you took?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And you hit it pretty much spot on, which is, like, we see ourselves as, like, experts, but ultimately the developers, they own the security of their product. And so when we engage with them, we try to come in with tools, approaches, preferred methodologies. We use the terminology paved road or paved path, which I think has started to propagate a little bit across the industry. But that's definitely something that we're really focused on, is, like, you're trying to solve this use case. Like, here's the technology you use. Here's the approach to do it. And by the way, if you're using our tech, you get support and all these other things. So we try to really sort of wrangle in people with that approach, which I think works well overall. And of course, the areas we have to improve is try to make our products better, easier to use, all those types of things.
I've heard of a bunch of people in similar roles to you. You know, like, one way that they have a lot of success is they build, you know, really security friendly, you know, repos and whatnot, right? And have developers use their infrastructure. So they build it. It's like, you know, I don't know if you remember, there was a TED talk about a guy who ran a ethical foie gras farm where he basically built this garden for the geese who would just choose to fly in. There was no fence. They would just fly in and feast on the plants that he'd put there. Sort of like that approach, right? You just build them all the shiny tools, you know, but there happens to be all of the code scans and you know, static analysis. It's all there. That's, I mean, right. Is that something you're doing?
Yeah, that's really what we're doing. We're trying to sort of, we have this, like, minimum baseline that we really want people to use. If you use just the baseline sets of tools, our preferred build CI tooling to sort of ship your code to production, our preferred tools for, you know, secret management, a couple other things, you know, you get a lot of security benefit for that. And what we try to do is, you know, we think about the types of operation our customers do. Sometimes they want to put an application on the internet. Sometimes they want to talk to sensitive data. And we try to curate a story for them to get there as fast as possible. So again, like, showing them that if they use our tooling, that not only is it reducing risk, but it's actually making them more productive. I know you've heard the analogy, hey, security folks are like brakes on a car. They actually let you drive faster. It's not really slowing you down. You can drive faster because you have brakes. I really think that that's what we're trying to do. Like, hey, we're going to give you all this stuff. You can actually go faster if you use our stuff versus rolling your own.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about standing up all of this infrastructure you're going to need when you could just use ours. And sure, there's a couple of extra controls here, but net win for you.
Yeah, and one of the ways that we're really trying to sort of sell this and make this work better than even, I think, in the past over the last couple of years is, like, this idea of consolidating. And, you know, and I think this is something that's happening a little bit more sort of external to security outside of Netflix as well, which is, like, It's one thing if we have these various tools that provide capabilities, you know, single sign-on, secret management, certificate management, et cetera. We sort of have all these different products. Even if I have all those things and I present them to you, you kind of have to be a little bit of an expert with them all, right? Like, you have to kind of figure out, like, when do I go to one of these things? When do I set up my certificate? When do I set up my security component related to this part of the stack? And again, I think that we have an opportunity to start consolidating more of that stuff. So a big focus area for me lately has been even raising that up another level, not just saying like we have a paved road, we're going to like consolidate these into like a product or like a use case and think about that end to end so that when you adopt our piece of technology, not only do you get like the single sign-on, but you get the firewall, you get the secret management, you get the TLS certificate management, you get the logging and the telemetry. And when we start to bundle all that stuff together, our customers are getting quite excited because we're bundling it with other things, not just security. Like I mentioned, telemetry, like we're putting good logging in there. We're putting in stuff.
Yeah,
related.
Yeah. I mean, this is the way to do it, right? You're basically a service provider offering them stuff that they need that's tailored for your needs as well. So, yes. I mean, it is a net win. I mean, have you had any specific areas of pushback on some of these things that you're offering?
Yeah. You know, I think in general, the pushback often is like, it works for me 80%.
Yeah.
You know, it gets me 80% to the finish line. And then it's who carries that last mile, who carries that last bit of technology. And I don't think we've cracked that yet. I don't think we've cracked exactly how do we straddle that last little bit of the integration work or the last little bit of onboarding the tech. And I think we have a way to go there. You know, I think generally,
Can you give me one sort of real tangible example of where a dev just like there's one little thing that pisses them off? Like, what's an example?
Sure. Well, let's talk access control because I think that's an interesting one. And you know, access control tends to be one of those security things that is kind of like, I don't know, a lot of the security work we do as defenders like falls in access control. It's like one of the best tools we have to mitigate risk. It's also one of the most complex. It's like, if you think about it, like fine-grained access control, some of these things are really hard. Our customers today, even if we present them with like an aggregated project or an aggregated product, they still have to do access control configuration, and it's hard. Sometimes
so that's the thing where you actually they are required this way to actually go through and give fine-tuned permissions instead of just hey, everybody gets root.
Yeah. And it's that's a whole different can of worms there. But on the access control side, it's complex for our developers because in some circumstances they might have to manage policies in two different systems. So we kind of have them do double bookkeeping. They're like they go to one to configure the user auth and another to configure the service auth. And this is part of the sort of organic growing of a security team in a company like Netflix. You know, we built some solutions and they got wide adopted, and now we have to really think about how we bring those things together. So, you know,
so that's you're saying that is your problem to fix rather than their thing to adapt to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think again, like if someone comes to me and says, the hardest thing about working with security is access control and authorization. It's just hard. I have to touch two systems. It's hard. We had a developer come to us once and say this. I thought this was really interesting. They said, I don't know if I have the confidence I've done the right thing. Like, I don't know if my policy is right, which is interesting because access control requires like some business context, right? If you think about.
Yeah. So how are you going to know it's right? Who knows if it's right? Yeah, that's your problem, isn't it?
Who knows if it's right? And so I started to think about that and was like, well, that's a real. Is that a problem that we could actually solve? And I actually think, yes, we can. I think we can address that. And the way we address that is similar to what Travis mentioned when he talked to you a few years ago, when you spoke to Travis McPeak on his project, RepoKit,
that's the one, yep.
Yeah. And, you know, for listeners who might not be familiar with RepoKit, RepoKit was a mechanism to automatically tune AWS identity permissions over time, really by just kind of looking at how applications and infrastructure are using those permissions.
Yeah, basically, if you weren't using a permission, it would go away.
Yeah, it would go away. We're thinking of the same thing with access policy. So, you know, let's imagine that we have an application. It's got SSO. And, you know, today we have it locked down to everybody at Netflix, you know, thousands of users. But over the period of like 9 months, we really only see 5 users from one organization logging in. We might be able to then recommend a policy to just lock down that access policy to that organization. So maybe we take that policy from 8,000 members to 50.
Now, look, you're here, obviously, as an employee of Netflix, but this is a Signal Sciences sponsor slot.
Yeah.
I'm guessing the reason they nominated you to do this is because you roll Signal Sciences as a matter of course. Yeah. Is that part of the standard toolkit?
That's exactly right. And again, Signal Sciences is super easy for us to use. We've been using them for years. It's our preferred mechanism for protecting L7, firewall, in the cloud. But we, saw an opportunity to make that even easier. So what we've done is we have this, effectively our product that we're sort of shipping around is this like externalized proxy. You know, you can almost think of like a sidecar that we sort of ship alongside applications. And what we're, aimed to do with that is we've embedded Sig Sci, we've embedded other, pieces of tech into that. Developers get turnkey solution. They do a couple steps to get onboarded into this proxy and they're good to go. They don't have to manage the firewall. They don't look at it.
So you're basically running your own cloud WAF.
We're running our own cloud. That's exactly right. We're seriously
That solves your problem when it comes to aggregating logs, doesn't it? Because it's all happening in the one place.
Absolutely. Again, like not only do we get the sort of Signal Sciences as one of the interfaces there, we get the consolidated point where we do access control, which I can log to build policy improvements over time. So, like, it's kind of setting us up to get to that end state where it's like, not only do you get all these awesome benefits, but every 90 days, I'll give you a recommendation on a new policy. And, maybe a new piece of technology comes out, a new security control, just roll it into the proxy. And you as an app owner don't have to worry about it. And I really think that's a nice shift. You know, before we were a lot of focus in sort of the runtime and add this package, you manage the security dependencies, install this client library. It's just a lot of work to shift on the developers. Again, if we can remove that whole part and say, don't add our library, we'll just put it in the sidecar that we manage for you. I think that gives us a lot of leverage. I think that gives us a stronger conversation.
All right. Well, Scott Behrens, thank you very much for joining us on the show to walk through your approach to the App Security Challenge at Netflix.
Sure.
It's been a real pleasure to chat to you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That was Scott Behrens of Netflix there, closing out this week's show. He, of course, was appearing in a Signal Sciences sponsor slot. Big thanks to Signal Sciences for sponsoring this week's show, and extra big thanks to them for lining up a customer interview because we always enjoy those. And congratulations to all of the hard-working folk at Signal Sciences on their acquisition by Fastly. And that is it for this week's show. We'll be back next week with more Risky Biz. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.